others are.
Okay, we have some work to do. Let's get down to business. First, for those people who want to walk out now, there is a video of this lecture in a very early draft from about 10 years ago. It's available online. The only possible value you can get out of it is to see what a distance is covered between thinking you have something well prepared and getting to the next stage. You can also, if you get that video, you can hear a Christian theologian respond to me. That's important for you. There. The better version was already presented in December of 2010 in First Things. This was when I was a regular writer for them, before I was elevated to the status of Litvak at large. But to do what we've got to do today, which I think is a more advanced version, the subject is Shir HaShirim. I will say some general things about how Mefarshim understand Shir HaShirim, and then I'll move on to the things I have to say that are original and I hope also true. Number one, the Jewish understanding of Shir HaShirim is that it's not a secular love story. It is a poem about the relationship of the Jewish people, of the Jew and God. That can be boiled down to two major alternatives. One is to view Shir HaShirim as a story about, or an allegory, of the relationship of God and the Jewish people. That view is found in Rashi, in Ibn Ezra, in many other Mefarshim. The second view is to view Shir HaShirim as an allegory of the relationship of the individual and God. That position was taken primarily by what people we call Jewish philosophers. The Rambam is most famous, even though the Rambam's discussion is very brief. He doesn't write a commentary on Shir HaShirim. He makes a passing remark in the Menuchim. But others in that tradition, the Ralbag, and all the other quote-unquote Jewish philosophers, adopt that approach. Offhand, there's no reason that one approach should exclude the other approach. Both can be correct. And if you look at the footnotes to the Rav's essay, Ubikashta Misham, the Rav makes it very clear that both options are legitimate options, and one does not exclude the other. For those people who like YU anecdotes, the Rav presented this view in Shir as well, whereupon one of the students in the Shir pointed out that double allegory is found in English literature as well. If you look at Edmund Spenser's Fairy Queen, there are two levels of allegory, both of which are clearly intended. The second stage of that anecdote is that several years later, that particular student was giving his own shir. He was discussing Shir HaShirim. He pointed out that there are two approaches and that one does not necessarily exclude the other. He asked, can anybody think of an example in English literature where this is true? And several of us who knew the story said Spenser's Fairy Queen, and Ablichin Sinzichon Vracha said very good, and just went on giving the shiur. And the third version that of Lichtenstein was in the United States. And one Sunday afternoon around this time, he was in the cafeteria here, and I was at the same table. Fortunately, he went away at that moment. He ran off to get something additional. Students ran into the cafeteria. They ran up to me, and they said, "We asked him about Shira Shirim last night, and he mentioned the Fairy Queen." I said, "You didn't trust me?" And, well, we wanted to hear it with our own ears. And by the time the Lichtenstein came back to the table, everything was quiet, everything was in order already. But in any event, there's no exclusiveness of either taking one approach or taking the other approach. The question that I want to raise, however, goes one step beyond that footnote in the Rav or that lecture by Rav Lichtenstein. My question is not how do Mefarshim interpret Shira Shirim, but how does a Jew read Shira Shirim? If you think of somebody who simply picks up Shira Shirim and reads, very often in our Sidurim you find Shira Shirim right before Kabbalat Shabbos, Kabbalat Shabbat, if I were pronouncing it properly. When I was a child, I knew many people who come to shul early, they would read Shira Shirim or Shira Shirim. I know young people today know Sephardic shuls where they read Shira Shirim publicly before Kabbalah. What do people think about when they're reading Shira Shirim? Most Jews are not thinking about the passages in Mor Nevuchim. Most Jews who are reading Shira Shirim don't even know that the Ralbag wrote a commentary on Shira Shirim, or that all sorts of people wrote on Shira Shirim whom they never heard, whose name they never heard of. And most Jews definitely have heard of Rashi, but I don't see any reason to assume that the people who are sitting reading Shira Shirim in shul are sitting with a Tanakh in one hand and Rashi in the other hand, and they're working it out that way. What are they actually thinking about? It's a naive question, but part of a Jewish reading of Tanakh means looking at the way normal Jews, not stupid Jews, but you know, normal people, how do they, what do they get out of it? What are they reading at that point? Now, we'll raise an additional question. What exactly does the allegorical reading of Shira Shirim accomplish? A question you can ask about any allegorical reading. Don't ask me at Spencer's Fairy Queen because, number one, despite the fact that my Rebbe, one of my Rebbeim, virtually knew the poem by heart, I know as much as the average person in the street knows about Spencer. And even more important, Rashi and Ibn Ezra had no idea about that particular issue. But where does allegory come from? Study of classical literature. Homer, the Greek poet. I think part of what happened was that as classical or elite classical culture moved to a more sophisticated religious outlook, question: how we're reading Homer, and Homer has all these crazy stories about the gods and about the Greek gods. What is this all about? And we said, well, if we want to continue reading Homer and we don't want to laugh at what's going on there, let's reinterpret Homer's imagery in a way that is more philosophically acceptable. In effect, you substitute something philosophically acceptable for something that is overly anthropomorphic, pagan, and so on. But what does that do in real terms, other than solving a problem for a classic, for a certain Roman or late Greek intellectuals? What does it really do for us? Chazal, Rabbi Chiba says that Shirim HaKodesh and Shir HaShirim is Kodesh Kodeshim. It is special sanctity. What exactly does an allegory do to make it more special than anything else? It's something that bothered me, and all along, it bothered me even more when I did sit down and read something about the history of allegory in the non-Jewish world. And if I needed the courage to say this publicly, eventually I came across an anonymous 14th century commentary on Shir HaShirim. The author takes Ibn Ezra as being kind of the default line. And at a certain point, he says, I don't understand, what does Ibn Ezra want from me? Let's say Ibn Ezra's right, which means that you read Shir HaShirim and it's a one-to-one correspondence between the imagery in Shir HaShirim and the Torah. Yitziat Mitzrayim, Matan Torah, the whole story up to Golot. Let's say that's true. What makes Shir HaShirim more mysterious than Shmot? Manavshach. If you read Shmot, and Shmot tells you a story about the Exodus and about Matan Torah, without allegory. Manavshach. If Shir HaShirim is simply paraphrasing what you already have in Chumash, in more obscure language, what did you gain by it? And if it's not the same thing, then Ibn Ezra's barking up the wrong tree. Ibn Ezra's, and the same thing was said about Rashi, you're developing a whole system which is not what Shir HaShirim is really about. So why is Shir HaShirim so valuable? What is it that people are supposed to get out of presenting information that presumably we know already from Chumash, and presenting it or representing it in a more obscure, in a more mysterious kind of way? Now, why do we need this repackaging, this poetic paraphrase? What are we getting by it? Let me comment before we move any further. Somebody may have asked, thought, as I'm discussing the Farshim, isn't the allegorical approach older than the Rishonim? Isn't it in Midrash? Isn't it in Targum? Did I skip a stage? And my answer to that is, I didn't really skip a stage. I know what I'm doing. In Midrashim, you get a certain kind of typological reading of Shir HaShirim. When you read Shir HaShirim Rabbah, you read the Targum on Shir HaShirim, you're going to read things like, this pasuk refers to X, this pasuk refers to Y. That's not the allegorical reading that you're getting in Rashi and Ibn Ezra. What's the difference? When you look at Rashi and Ibn Ezra and anybody of their ilk, they are taking Shir HaShirim and they're developing a one-to-one correspondence that you read Shir HaShirim through, you have Tznach on one side, and you have the interpretation on the other side. If you look at Midrashim, the Midrashim are not claiming that Pasuk A means X and Pasuk B means Y. Very often in Midrashim, there will be a variety of different opinions. Rav so-and-so applied this Pasuk to this event in Tanakh. Rav Almoni applied this Pasuk to another event in Tanakh. That's not allegorization. That's simply darshaning the Pasuk. If I take events in early American history and I apply them to later American history, or if I apply them to today, that's not turning American history into an allegory, but just saying that it's useful to think of our problems today, or maybe our problems 50 years ago or 100 years ago, in terms of what was going on in the 18th century. That makes things more interesting, it makes things more edifying, it may be very valuable for a variety of reasons. It's not allegorization. Allegorization means that, to take a Christian example, that Virgil's second eclogue is really, really, really about Christianity. That's pshat in Virgil. Or that when Homer talks about the Greek gods, he really, really means certain more sophisticated philosophical concepts. It's not the same thing as a typological reading is applying things. In that sense, Rashi really, even though Rashi's quoting Chazal left and right, Rashi's really creating a revolution in terms of how we read Shir HaShirim. But again, we're back with the problem that I raised earlier. What do you gain by that allegory other than you have a certain kind of imagery? You have the kind of imagery that may tempt people to read it as a secular poem. But what do you gain by that? What do you gain by putting a veil over historical events, by treating them obscurely? Sometimes you can say it's fun. A lot of piyutim take events in Tanakh and they present them in all sorts of more obscure ways. And, you know, 1,500 years ago, maybe even today, people got pleasure reading piyutim, and you're talking about Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and you're using oblique ways of referring to them. It's like solving a crossword puzzle, if you excuse the expression. But again, why is that essential from a religious point of view, other than a literary or aesthetic point of view? Let's come back to this person reading Shir HaShirim Friday afternoon. A couple of things about that. Number one, I think that average reader, even though they're not sitting with Ibn Ezra on one side and Tanakh on the other side, or with even with Rashi in one hand and Tanakh in the other hand, nevertheless, I think that reader thinks about Shir HaShirim in communal terms. Whether or not he knows Rashi, whether or not he's interested in looking at Rashi, he thinks in communal terms. Allegorizing per se tends to alienate us from the text, because the text is one thing and the real interpretation is something else. But this kind of reading really makes the story in Tanakh, assuming that you're reading it that way, or the story of the relation of God and Knesset Yisrael, or Aliba de Rambam, the relationship between the individual and God, it makes it more intimate rather than less intimate. How is that accomplished? One point that, you know, I'm afraid some of you will think it's obvious once I say it, but it took me a while to think it through that way. So when it takes me time to think something through, it occurs to me that sometimes other people may not think of it immediately either. One thing is that the literary perspective in Shir HaShirim is different than the literary perspective that we find generally in the rest of Tanakh. Generally, in most of Tanakh, the perspective that dominates theologically is God's perspective. God commands. God creates. God judges. Once in a while, the Nevi'im are going to impersonate the people as well. The Navi will ventriloquize the voice of the people. And you can see how the people, at least the way the Navi presents the people, responding or failing to respond. But the overall perspective is that of God. What's remarkable about Shir HaShirim is Shir HaShirim is written pretty much from the viewpoint of the non-God, whether it's the Jewish people, the individual. It's written from that point of view. If you want to use the gross imagery, Shir HaShirim is written from the woman's point of view, not from the man's point of view. If you think of the poetry of that period, where it's written from the man's point of view. Take secular love poetry, ancient Near East, it's generally from the man's point of view. The man is the one who talks. The woman, you know, appears through the eyes of the man. Shir HaShirim is the other way around. And I think from purely historical point of view, it makes it more difficult to think of Shir HaShirim as a secular love poem. Because if it was, how come the ancient Near East doesn't have other examples of secular love poetry written from the woman's point of view? But if the major figure is God, and we're seeing God through a human perspective, that's a very different way of thinking and a more intimate way of thinking, at least an alternative way of thinking to what we have elsewhere in Tanakh. And that may be very important. Even the voice of the male lover, of the dod, is heard through the way that through the feminine voice that is reporting about on it. The history of God's relationship with Israel and his relationship with the individual, human soul, is a love story. Inevitably, a love story is not free of suffering, failure, misunderstanding, and unhappiness. You read most of Tanakh, there's nothing that contradicts what I just said, but in most of Tanakh, you talk about obedience or disobedience, righteousness and sin. To that extent, you're leaving out some of the emotional palette of that relationship. And don't tell me that there are enough passages elsewhere in Tanakh, in Yirmiyahu, in Hosea, in Yechezkel, that supply this. I'm speaking about the dominant mood. In Shir HaShirim, even though the Mefarshim can say, well, when God is disappointed in Israel, and God distanced himself from Israel, it's because of sin. The Mefarshim can say that. When you're just reading Shir HaShirim, the language of sin and obedience is not the dominant language. And again, if you think of the analogy of human love relationships, it may be legitimate. There are times you can say, well, whose fault is it? But what dominates very often is understanding, misunderstanding, yearning. You read Shir HaShirim again without the Mefarshim, even if the Mefarshim are in the back of your mind. It's a story about a man and a woman. They're in love with each other, and somehow they never meet. You know, the woman hears his voice. She hears his voice. And then he disappears. There's a point he knocks on the door, and for whatever reason, she's not ready for him. And when she is ready, he's gone. He's ready, she's not ready. When she is looking for him, he's not there. It leaves out the fault-finding, the question of, you know, obedience or disobedience. And I think that's part of the relationship between man and God, or Knesset Yisrael and God, that we might be missing if we didn't have that element. We didn't have the Shir HaShirim that we have. And it also means that when we read Shir HaShirim, even though we should read Shir HaShirim with the Mefarshim are very important, nevertheless, there's a point where we have to step back and read more naively. And at that point, your recollection of what Rashi said, or Ibn Ezra said, or the Rambam, that's in the background. What you're experiencing right now is that raw emotional story of appointment and disappointment, if you excuse the pun, this yearning for meeting, which seems to be frustrated, which never seems to be fulfilled in a perfect way in our lives. Well, this cost me a lot of thinking to get through, but I had one help, whom I have not mentioned. Well, I mentioned his name, I didn't go further with him. The Rav. You take the Rav's Vikashta Misham, which the English is called Ye Shall Seek From There, which is, there are different opinions. I mean, one person whom I respect does not hold that Vikashtim is the Rav's most important work. There are two people who do consider Vikashtim to be the Rav's most important theological work. One of them is me, which may not count for very much, and the other one, who, again, you may want to disagree with him, is the Rav. Imagine the Rav's own private comments carry some weight. And you know, I can say more about that, but not for the moment. The Rav, Vikashtim Misham, is about the relationship of man and God. The overture to Vikashtim is a comment on Shir HaShirim. And if you take a look, yeah, you read this essay. You read the Rav already. If you read the way that Rav presents it, he's presenting it as a narrative. In the footnote, he does the heavy theological work of Rashi and the Rambam, and you know all the normative issues about reading Shir HaShirim as a religious work. But in the text itself, he simply describes A. He begins with the Jew sitting in shul reading Shir HaShirim. Now, why did he do that? It adds a certain charm, you know, frame within a frame. But why is he doing this? You know, great writers don't do these things simply in order to play a trick or to have an excuse to describe a sunset. Writers like sunsets. James Joyce, Agnon. And the Rav likes, from time to time, the Rav likes to have a sunset in his essays as well. But why is he, the setting sun of the Sabbath Eve ignites the western horizon, and the Sabbath queen, delicate, pleasing, and graceful as a bride. It sounds better in Hebrew, but why is he doing this? I think there's a simple reason. The Rav understood what it took me a while to figure out, that if you're asking not how did Rashi interpret Shir HaShirim, which you can do in the footnote, if you're asking how does the naive, intelligent Jew read Shir HaShirim, you have to put the reading of Shir HaShirim not in the context of a Bible class or a shir, you have to put that reading in the context of the liturgy of Friday afternoon. That's where that reading is at home. And then you move from that larger framework of somebody sitting in shul. You can almost imagine a camera moving. You can imagine a movie where you have somebody sitting in shul reading, and then you switch from the shul image to the Shir HaShirim image. The woman who yearns for her heart's chosen one, her lover who pastures his flock among the lilies, has sworn eternal love. The lover longs for his faithful bride, his soul thirsts for her. The most beautiful of women wanders, and everything from here on in is a description of the manifest content. The Rav does not allegorize, he describes, he paraphrases what's going on in Shir HaShirim. Now, there's I could say a lot more, but there's one point that I want to emphasize here about the way that Rav paraphrases the storyline of Shir HaShirim. Since Shir HaShirim read naively, which I mean intelligently as well, Shir HaShirim is obscure. I don't mean that you have trouble identifying the flowers or the physical features of Eretz Yisrael. That's the easy part. Especially if you have the Dat Mikra and Shir HaShirim, and there was a botanist, Professor Felix, I took a course with, who wrote about the botany. The issue is not the botany. The issue is psychology. These people are people, I mean, the male lover, the female, God, Knesset Yisrael, God and the individual. The behavior is frankly irrational. Not unknown when you talk about lovers. But it's irrational. How do you explain something irrational? Now, Shir HaShirim doesn't have to do it because it's poetry, it's allegory. You have an image, and let the reader do what he or she wants with that image. But the Rav may be gifted literarily, may be a hard worker in literature, but he's writing prose here. How do you explain what's going on? So when it comes to the male figure, the Ribbono Shel Olam, he simply doesn't. He tells you the man, you know, he shows up, he doesn't show up, but there's no attempt to get into the psyche of the Ribbono Shel Olam, Kedyachol. And you understand very well why. Again, you are talking about God and divine initiative and response is ultimately inscrutable. What about the female character? I put it near the Rav is understandably circumspect in his description of the divine figure. He confines himself to descriptions found in the biblical text. He refrains from supplementing them with psychological terms. But what about the woman? The woman is a human being, according to the Rambam, or Knesset Yisrael. The psychology of Knesset Yisrael may be a little bit more obscure than that of an individual, but still it's a human psychology. So there, the Rav does introduce psychological language. He tries to paraphrase the poetry in a manner that would make sense in a novel or a biography. Ani Shena B'Libier, famous psukim in Perakei, the woman says, I am asleep, my heart is awake. Call the Dofek, the voice of the lover knocking, open the door, and as I mentioned before, she is indifferent. She doesn't respond. You read Shir HaShirim, I asked you, reading Shir HaShirim, why doesn't she respond? There's no answer that makes sense in religious terms. The language that you actually get in Shir HaShirim, the woman says, Pashati et kutonti echachal b'shena, I've already taken off my clothes, v'chatsi et raglai, I washed my feet, echachat tanfim, if I get up to open the door, my feet will get dusty, I'll have to put on clothing again, and that's why she doesn't open the door. In the real world, that really may be true. And if I went to bed already and you knock on my door, I might just pretend to be asleep, and even if I want to see you. But you know, people are lazy, people are tired. You know, but that's not a religiously meaningful. You really have a lover. You've been walking outside. You've been looking for him. You've been jeered at, you've even been smitten by the shomrim, by the watchmen, And now he turns up, and you say, well, I washed my feet already, and you better have a better answer than that. Again, in the real world, people are rational that way, but we're talking now about a physical description that corresponds to some religious moment. So here, the Rav does give a prose paraphrase. The cold of the moonless, starless night, deep weariness, laziness, and fear combined to paralyze her will and bind her legs. In other words, he says that she's being irrational. At the same time, he's giving psychological terms that make a little more sense, that bring this reaction closer to the way real people would respond. The biblical text does not provide compelling evidence for the particular motive suggested by the Rav. It's not that the Rav is copying what's in Tanakh, he's using his own thinking. The reference to her fear, one point that Rav says she's afraid, is a particularly bold and unpredictable stroke. Fear of what? Again, nothing Shir HaShirim says it. I didn't open the door because I was afraid. But the Rav knows that there is fear under those circumstances. Is she afraid she'll be disappointed? Is she afraid that he'll run away again? She's deluding herself. Now, just read what I wrote at the end of the printed article. For most of the past millennium, Jewish religious philosophers such as the Rambam have begun with the raw material of religious experiences found in Tanakh and undertaken to present it in more abstract form. I mean, like the Lahavdil, the classical allegorizers, you take raw material and you present it in a more philosophical way, to purify anthropomorphic language and tone down the mythical connotations of religious imagery. Healthy religious thinking on this view needed to rise above concessions to the primitive imagination. Intellect is higher than imagination, and we have to redeem imagery with abstraction. The philosophers could do so because they were able to rely on the backdrop of a living experience. They started from an emotional, real experience, and then they philosophized about it. For our age, overly captivated by abstraction, the task of philosophical reflection is often to reverse the process. That the work that I have to do, and if you don't care about me, the work that the Rav set himself to do, the work that somebody very different from the Rav, like Rav Kook, but somebody who understood the same problems of the 20th century and 21st century, you look at Rav Kook. You look at other major Jewish thinkers, the ones who didn't simply read a book on philosophy and then copy from it, but the ones who asked real questions and brought whatever they had in them to that. The task very often is to reverse the process, to start from an abstract way of thinking and to recover the living experience. Because he is both the commanding other and the intimate partner, he conceals himself from us even as he seeks our fellowship. Underlying the Jewish ability to respond to God is the awareness of our own enigmatic destiny as individuals and members of his people, at once creative and submissive, questing for him and yet all too frequently failing to respond to his initiative. All scripture rehearses that intimate, holy story of revelation. Shir HaShirim is Kodesh Kodashim. And we covered a lot of ground in, I don't know whether I went over the time, it was a lot to me or not, covered a lot of ground, and I hope you covered it clearly enough so people can come away with an understanding, some can bring to your own reading of Shir HaShirim and to your own study of Tanakh and Toga and your own religious life.